A plane full of wolves is in the air. It's heading from Canada, where they've been trapped, to Montana, where they'll be let go. It's the first step in a monumental reintroduction of wolves. There'd been years of preparation for this moment. Even in the months just before, the logistics were a nightmare. Ed Bangs was with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the time.
We worked with local trappers up there, and we just figured out, you know, kind of how to get our hands on a bunch of wolves and how to do veterinary care and make sure they weren't transporting diseases or parasites and all that stuff.
Even the more mundane preparation was tricky.
How do you get, you know, 20 wolf-sized dog kennels up into Canada? Well, you rent a big truck and you drive them up across the border.
So everything's ready to go. The wolves are on the way. But while they're up in the sky, a court order lands on the ground. The wolves, a federal judge says, can't be let go.
So we're doing all this stuff, and all of a sudden, everything grinds to a halt.
The wolves, wild animals ready for release, are stuck in their cages like ordinary lap dogs.
It was a mess. So we'd been stopped by litigation, and so we had these wolves destined for Idaho in these really small dog kennels. I mean, the size of a big dog kennel. It was small, and it was a big metal thing.
The 20-year battle between farmers and environmentalists keeps them locked inside metal travel cases while the two sides argue in federal court.
They need to be let free. So does the spirit and the imagination of all of us.
We'd have to put ice in the cage with them. We had a bunch of wolves in these containers in the aircraft hangar in Missoula. And so, you know, me and another guy were sleeping in an aircraft hangar, putting ice in these cages, trying to keep these wolves alive to be able to release them.
Stressed out and dehydrated, people wonder if they'll survive the journey at all. The Secretary of the Interior at the time, Bruce Babbitt, made an appearance in person for the reintroduction. In this clip, he's talking with a reporter about the potentially deadly delay.
If we have to take them out of here, those cages will be coffins. The clock's running, and it's really important that we get this resolved as quickly as possible.
Meanwhile, the wolves remain in limbo. It's unclear whether their future is freedom or execution in the land they once called home.
Wolves had been killed off in the Northern Rockies decades earlier. Nobody knew what would happen when they came back. They might establish and breed and throw the ecosystem back into some semblance of balance. That was the hope. Or they might bolt north for the Canadian border, back home. But the biggest barriers were social. They might eat a bunch of cows and get shot by ranchers, or wind up pelts on cabin walls. But first, before any of those hypotheticals came to fruition, they just had to get out of those cages.
Keeping them alive in those containers, which they were only supposed to be in for maybe 8 hours or 10 hours, for 3 days was tough.
From Montana Public Radio and the Montana Media Lab, this is the first season of The Wide Open, Threatened. I'm Nick Mott. This time, a plane full of wolves sets loose a predator lost to the landscape for decades, and with it, questions about what recovering a species actually means. Stay with us. After the ESA was passed, gray wolves were one of the first species to make the endangered list. In a way, they were an obvious choice for protections. They were charismatic, and people had been driving them toward extinction for decades. Largely in the name of protecting cattle, wolves had been set on fire, their jaws torn out, their Achilles cut. Animal carcasses were laced with poison to attract and kill them. Settlers set fire to entire swaths of forest to weed out wolf hiding spots. In the early days of the act, an idea was put out there to bring them back. It wouldn't be through purely natural means. Instead, they'd be reintroduced, brought back to some of the places where they'd been exterminated. Convincing wildlife managers, lawmakers, and the public the time was right took decades. But by the early 1990s, plans were set in motion to release wolves in both Yellowstone National Park and the remote River of No Return Wilderness in Idaho.
The howl of the wolf has not been heard there since the 1930s, when government bounty hunters successfully exterminated the animal. Then and now, the wolf is feared by ranchers and considered a threat to other wildlife.
And that's the world Doug Smith plunged into when he moved to southwest Montana in 1994.
You know, I was 34 years old, and I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and I just wanted to do a good job.
Doug is tall and lean, with a gray handlebar mustache. He recently retired from about three decades as Yellowstone National Park's lead wolf biologist.
How's retired life?
It's a lot to get used to. There's some things I love about it and some things I miss greatly.
Doug spent his career as a bit of a wolf ambassador, giving them voice to the public. His job in Yellowstone meant he was routinely darting and collaring wolves, sometimes from a helicopter. He'd trek through parts of Yellowstone's backcountry into which few humans venture. It really is a lot to miss, I imagine. I'm driving Doug up Yellowstone's winding north entrance road into his old stomping grounds to talk all things wolves. It's spring, and the vegetation in the park is coming back to life from its winter slumber. We pass elk and bison, and as we chat about wolves, I point out some other four-legged critters I spot out the corner of my eye a little ways away.
Oh yeah, there's a pronghorn. This is the kind, you know, this is a good green up here, and those pronghorn are riding the green wave, as they say it.
As wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, it set off this cascade of questions, all about wolf recovery. What would a population of wolves mean for the ecosystem here? For everything from those pronghorn to elk to aspen. And outside the park, what would wolf recovery mean for people?
National parks are, okay, the natural system is in place, let nature take its course. And for me, that's my personal philosophy. And so, you know, there's an old Western term called, you know, can you ride the brand of the company you work for? I could ride that brand. Restore the pieces and step back. I believed in that deeply.
Inside the park, unlike outside of it, the land is managed to be nearly wholly separate from human influence. But of course, wolves have no regard for the lines we draw on the land.
What was the reaction like in the community surrounding the park at the time?
It's tiresome. It's like everything else with wolves. It was explosive, it was cataclysmic, controversial. Wolves just, they're a cultural phenom. If you've ever been at a party or at a gathering and someone walks in and their vibe and their charisma changes everything in the room, that's what it was like the day wolves came back to Yellowstone.
Our other guide into the world of wolves is Ed Banks, formerly with the Fish and Wildlife Service.
I was the wolf recovery coordinator for like 15 years.
At the FWS, the brand Ed was riding was a good bit different than Doug's over at the Park Service. He was dealing with all that land where people, and with them, their divergent attitudes about wildlife and livelihood came into the mix too.
Everybody thinks, oh, this guy must be a wolf lover or something. And I'm not really. I mean, it's nothing against wolves. I mean, they're okay. It's like I hate them or anything. But they always reminded me of just big dogs walking around.
At the same time as reintroduction was in the works, some wolves had been naturally spreading into Montana too. Ed came to the state as the first wolves had crossed the border into Montana from Canada and ate some cows just east of Glacier National Park. From years spent in Alaska, he understood the clash of emotions the animal could create.
People that don't like wolves use human terms like they're greedy, they're cruel, they're wasteful, you know, they don't go to church regularly, whatever. And it's to describe them, to try and give them the aura of evil. And so people that like wolves, describing as their great parents, their loving spouses, their loyal family members, they balance the ecosystem, you know, they want to make people's lives better, and they would fix everything in the world if we would just let them. And so none of those things are really true on either side.
In the West, wildlife often is politics. To many people on the ground, wolf reintroduction felt like the federal government forcing its ideas on rural communities in the West. To them, it was a way of changing lifestyle and culture and livelihood for the benefit of wildlife watchers from the city. The issue is not wolves. The issue is control of the land. This is part of a bigger agenda from the Interior Department to control the West, the president of the Wyoming Farm Bureau told a reporter at the time. Others still welcomed the wolves back and wanted them to have even stronger protections. As the rhetoric on both sides ballooned, Ed Bangs organized and ran dozens of public meetings. As the government put together the environmental impact statement, he printed by hand 750,000 copies. About 170,000 public comments came in from every state, in fact, from more than 40 countries.
We had one of our hearings, just to give you an example of how nutty it went. In the first row, there was a bunch of people dressed like Native Americans. That was the Earth Firsters, you know, kind of dancing around being something, I don't know, the pro-wolf. And then we had a woman step in a pioneer outfit from like a Western, and she pulled a baby out from under her dress and was like, "There'll be dead children within a year if we reintroduce wolves."
The sentiment was deeply polarizing and often personal.
I had people like, "I'm going to kill you, your family, and burn your house down and kill your dog." And it's like, well, thanks for sharing that and come again.
By January 1995, all the paperwork and public meetings were done. Reintroduction had the official federal sign-off, and wolves were in the air.
Twelve gray wolves rounded up less than a week ago in Canada were headed for new homes in Yellowstone and central Idaho.
But for decades, absent most natural predators, the Yellowstone elk population had burgeoned, overgrazing both in and around the park. For a time, the problem was so bad, park rangers themselves killed thousands of elk every winter to control the population. The hope was wolves would bring some semblance of balance back to the ecosystem. The government hired professional trappers to catch a dozen wolves in Canada. They flew them south to Montana, where they'd be split into two groups. Eight would be released into Yellowstone, and four into Idaho's River of No Return wilderness. The captured wolves were corralled into what amounted to big dog cages. There aren't specific luxury wolf kennels, after all. Those who didn't want wolves to come back looked everywhere for a way to stop it.
Ever since the Endangered Species Act of 1973 allowed for the reintroduction of wolves to the American Northwest, ranchers have been fighting their return, fearing a loss of livestock.
Those anti-reintroduction groups found a last-second strategy in the courts. Here's Doug.
And very frustratingly, because this lawsuit was filed by the Farm Bureau, kind of a dirty trick, while the wolves were en route.
And because of that lawsuit, a judge said,
we had to leave them in their crates. We carried them into the pens, put them in there, in cages basically, and left them there and walked away. And we had to wait and see what the judge's ruling was.
That's where Ed fed them ice in an aircraft hangar to keep them alive. There was worry about kidney failure and dehydration, along with the stress of the journey. Animal rights groups threatened to sue for animal cruelty. But there was nothing the feds could do about it. The wolves were stuck. Ultimately, the judge decided against the Farm Bureau. The wolves could be released and reintroduction could proceed. And they survived. They didn't die in their kennels, despite that last-minute lawsuit.
I mean, there's always been litigation because, I mean, that's what people do. You know, in the old days, we just hit somebody in the head with an axe. Now you sue them. That's always been part of the wolf stuff.
Ed Bangs was there to help with the Idaho release, driving through a winter storm with a brigade of news trucks in tow. Even after the days in cages, everything seemed to still be falling apart.
And of course, the road was completely iced over. It was a horror show. It was a complete mess. When I opened the first cage and the wolf actually ran away and then ran across an ice bridge over the river and disappeared into the wilderness, I just thought, thank God it's still alive. I could just see it run out of the cage and fallen dead right in front of me and 50 news organizations. And, you know, that would have been a horror show. But it worked out. So luck beats skill every time.
Doug was in Yellowstone, where the process was a bit different than in Idaho. There, they didn't want the wolves scrambling north for the Canadian border. Instead of opening the cages and letting them run free, they kept the wolves in the large pen for 10 days to break their homing response. Despite all the publicity and fanfare, the actual opening of the cages was a more private affair in the park.
It's the middle of the night. I mean, it was literally, you know, 2, 3 a.m. in the morning, which is kind of cool. You know, you're up there snowshoeing, middle of the night, in Yellowstone, wolves, with just a couple other people. Yeah, it was one of the better memories of my life. And so we just pulled the doors and walked away.
As it all went down, eyes across the world were on what would happen when wolves were set loose in the Northern Rockies.
I mean, it was huge theater. And you could argue that Yellowstone itself is one of the greatest conservation arenas in the world. before wolves got here. And then you bring in this species that is controversial across the Northern Hemisphere.
8 gray wolves are on the ground in Yellowstone National Park. They're roaming a 1-acre pen until they get used to the surroundings.
I mean, I'm talking North America, Europe, Asia, and you bring it into this conservation theater of Yellowstone, and it's just headlines, above the fold headlines, worldwide news. And that's exactly the way it played out. I heard people were in China and saw it on TV there. It was a huge event.
By the end of 1996, 31 wolves had been released into Yellowstone, and another 35 along the Salmon River in Idaho. Opening the doors to those cages set off a series of events we're still dealing with today. We'll be back.
The Wide Open is supported by the Murray and Jan Ritland Fund, the Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and listeners like you. Ways to contribute and make this kind of journalism possible at mtpr.org.
Welcome back to The Wide Open. When Doug and Ed opened the door to those wolf cages, they unleashed changes in both the human and non-human landscape. The wolves got to work doing wolf stuff, killing elk, along with the occasional sheep or cow, exploring the wilds of the Northern Rockies, and breeding. And nearly 30 years after reintroduction, there's a thriving wolf population in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
I'm in Yellowstone National Park, and former wolf project leader Doug Smith and I are pulled off the road, binoculars pasted to our faces in Yellowstone's famous Northern Range. It's this vast open space. We can see for miles in every direction. Because of all the wildlife visible here, some call it America's Serengeti. Doug and I are looking for wolves, but the sun is bright overhead, so we're not particularly optimistic.
It's a bit early. You know, wolves are, it's a cool word, crepuscular, which means waning light, which means wolves are active kind of morning, evening. And here we are. We're a hair early for the wolf activity period for this evening.
For me, like so many people, seeing wolves is something special. I've happened upon them a number of times in the park, but although I've come across all kinds of sign, I've never actually seen them outside its boundaries. But one time, while I was calling for elk in cold, drizzling rain while hunting, a whole herd started howling, probably less than a mile from me. I've never experienced anything like it. Right now, about 120 wolves live in Yellowstone. They're separated into roughly 10 packs. In a park almost the size of Connecticut, our odds aren't particularly good to be in the right spot at the right time. But with Doug, I certainly have a leg up.
I just heard a raven, and ravens are considered the wolf bird.
Ravens follow wolves to eat and cache the food of animal carcasses. But the relationship between the two species is much more nuanced and mysterious than one based on food alone. Ravens sometimes play with wolf pups. They've been seen flying over wolves with sticks to get them to hop into the air. Some scientists and wildlife watchers even speculate that the relationship might run deeper, that individual birds might form bonds with individual wolves.
There's one in a tree over there. Yeah, that lodgepole pine that's dead at the top.
Since I live so close, I drive through the park quite a bit, especially in winter when the tourist traffic calms down. But in peak season, it's common to see pileups of people doing exactly what Doug and I are up to. Drive through any given day, and you might find a cadre of wolf watchers peering intently through spotting scopes at a pack in the distance, munching on a bison carcass or just lazing contentedly in the sun. There's arguably nowhere else in the world better for seeing wolves. And wolf tourism here has taken off among Yellowstone's roughly 4 million annual visitors. Estimates vary, but wolf tourism specifically generates more than $80 million a year for communities around the park. As I'm scanning the hills, I think I see something. Some shapes, skylined on a ridge.
Yeah, I might see something up on the ridge. So there's some stuff, there's something on the ridge, it's very far.
Doug and I have met a couple times before, and he acts like he remembers me, but I think he's just being nice, because he keeps calling me Nate, and I'm too polite to correct him.
Well, Nate, if you spotted a wolf on your own, that's going to be really good.
I'm not that good. We never do find out what animals those shapes were. Doug suspects bison. From the moment those wolf cages got opened, there was this distinct finish line. delisting wolves, meaning removing their ESA protections. But that required figuring out how many wolves should there actually be. At what point are wolves quote-unquote recovered? As recovery coordinator for the FWS, Ed Bangs played a central role in trying to find an answer to that question.
The analogy is it's emergency room care. You have a patient who's dying, which is a species, and if they're dead, you can't bring them back. Once you get the patient stabilized and it's going to be okay, get them out of the emergency room. And so that's the purpose of the Endangered Species Act, is to get species recovered and out.
But legislating recovery is a hard thing to do, because this is a question that doesn't have a real answer. It's not like we all get to vote on how many wolves there should be. Scientists and bureaucrats more or less hash it out. There are these documents that get written when a species gets listed and revised over time. They suggest formal recovery goals. How many wolves, essentially, is the right amount? But answering this is really tricky. Should we look historically? Nobody knows exactly how many wolves there were in the U.S. back before white settlement, but they likely numbered in the hundreds of thousands, or even low millions. And when wolves came back to Yellowstone, the landscape had dramatically transformed. While the region did still have vast wilderness areas, as wolves crossed national park boundaries, they'd also have to contend with houses, cities, sheep, cows, cars, and highways, all these things that weren't there when their ancestors prowled the region. Plus, there's another wrench to throw in all this, too. One idea that's important to understand here is something called social tolerance. That's the notion that ecological limits aren't what should inform the size of the wolf population. Rather, it should be social limits, how people think about wolves. And keeping wolves on the endangered list breeds hate for the animal. Here's Doug Smith again.
A winning argument in the West is to hate the federal government. And if the federal government's keeping you from killing wolves, then you resent the heck out of them.
Without federal protections, it would be easier for ranchers to kill a wolf that's threatening their livestock. And there would almost certainly be wolf hunts scheduled in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. Now, this sounds like a recipe for a smaller wolf population, since it'd be a heck of a lot easier for people to kill wolves. But according to this line of thinking, which I should add, Doug doesn't necessarily agree with, getting rid of wolf protections could counterintuitively encourage people to accept a bigger population in the long run.
And if you remove those strictures and you make it possible to kill a wolf, both for causing problems and just because you want to hunt it, people aren't so angry. So it reduces their anger. And there may be some truth to that.
So how do we balance all this? Ed Bangs and the Fish and Wildlife Service team gave it a guess. The answer, as set into law in one of those recovery plans, dictated that recovery means at least 30 breeding pairs, basically 30 packs across Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, and a total population at least 300 strong for at least 3 years. Now, to onlookers, that might be a weird number. A population once in the hundreds of thousands is declared recovered when it numbers only in the hundreds. But for the federal government, that was enough. At that number, the population likely wouldn't backslide into extinction. And it's also few enough wolves, they likely wouldn't hit ranchers too hard.
My goal, as we set out the purpose of the program when I got here in 88, it was to get wolves recovered, get them delisted, and have them managed by the states just like every other animal, like elk and deer and mountain lions and black bears.
This means there would be local authorities, rather than federal ones, dictating all things wolf.
That was our goal from day one, was to get wolves delisted.
Ed was working himself out of a job. He told an interviewer decades ago he was ready for turtle watching in the tropics, sipping cocktails on the beach once wolves got off the endangered list.
That was my plan. You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Ed's road was always kind of rough. But let's sit for a minute in 2008, when things got especially hairy. Wolves have been on the ground for more than a decade. Unlike grizzly bears, they breed fast. A single female can produce a litter of 4 to 6 puppies every spring. Those 30-odd wolves reintroduced in the mid-90s had ballooned into a population about 1,500 strong in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, way over those recovery goals. Wolves were eating cattle, though fewer than researchers had originally anticipated. That year, wolves killed about 184 cows in the Northern Rockies and about 350 sheep. At least, that's what officials were able to confirm, which ranchers say could be but a fraction of actual losses. That's a lot to individual ranchers, sure, but not much compared to an overall cattle population running in the millions. Mostly, wolves ate elk. In fact, the Yellowstone area elk herd, 17 or 19,000 strong when wolves were reintroduced, had shrunk by well over half by 2008. Many hunters in the region were furious that their once bountiful opportunities for their annual haul of meat were becoming more scarce. In the Yellowstone area, the human population had grown by over 100,000 people, too. It looked to Ed and his colleagues at the Fish and Wildlife Service like it had long been time to delist wolves in the Northern Rockies. And they tried to get it done.
Earlier this month, the federal government announced the wolf has recovered, the plan to delist it.
For a few months in 2008, they officially came off the endangered species list. The states began to set up hunting seasons.
Wolf supporters believe it's too early to remove wolves from government protection.
They're rushing to take them off of the endangered species list because they're politically unpopular with a very politically powerful minority.
And who's that?
The livestock industry.
But as Ed knew was coming, environmental groups sued over the decision.
So what you hear is people bitch about, oh, you know, people are suing, blah, blah, blah. They only bitch when it doesn't, when it opposes what they believe should happen. If it's something they want and somebody's litigating over that, they're all for that. And so what you see, and this is what people do, you know, we're the same all over the world, and we've been the same for, what, 50,000 years in terms of our brain capacity and all that kind of stuff. We're just who we are.
The lawsuits allege that wolves weren't connecting enough between different populations to be genetically healthy. And there is an even deeper concern, too. Groups were especially worried about wolf hunting when management turned over to the states, which was understandable, listening to some of the rhetoric of the wolf hunting crowd. The Idaho governor said he'd put in for the first wolf tag himself, and that he'd support killing wolves off down to the bare minimum in the state required by the ESA, about 100 in Idaho. It also just sounds bad. Open season on wolves sounds to a lot of urban people like a return to the very forces that led to their near extinction. In that first lawsuit, Enviros won. Wolves went back on the endangered species list. But this cycle of litigation began. The government delisted wolves. Environmental groups sued. A federal judge ruled in favor of the Enviros. And then the whole thing would start all over again. It pitted states against the federal government and ranchers and hunters against environmental groups. Wyoming had a plan that was particularly hostile to wolves. They classified the animals as vermin in nearly 9/10 of the state, making it legal to kill wolves on site with no limits. For Ed Bangs, the whole thing was exasperating. He was like Sisyphus, pushing for delisting endlessly up a hill.
I think I wrote three recovery plans for Wyoming. I can't even remember. And I told people once, I said, if you come in my office and I'm laying dead over my keyboard because I'm working on another wolf delisting plan for the state of Wyoming, I don't even deserve to be buried. You should just drag me outside and throw me in the dumpster. What a waste of a life. And I ended up, I'm not sure stuck is the right word, but with the program to manage wolves to recovery. So that was pretty frustrating, as I thought I had a pretty good plan. And then it just all fell apart because of politics. But that's the nature of the beast.
The anti-wolf voices grew louder and angrier as what they perceived as activist judges reversed course on delisting and state management. And the pro-wolf folks viewed that increasing hostility as an even larger threat to wolves and more reason to keep them listed. Looking back, it feels like each side siloed itself, in part based on its fury with the other. And it all came back to this idea of what a recovered wolf population should mean.
Humans couldn't agree on what the right number of wolves was, and humans couldn't agree on how wolves should be managed. And so you had the states, primarily the state governments, wanting one thing, and you had other groups of people, primarily environmental groups, wanting another. Biology is not like chemistry or physics. It's an art form, whereas chemistry and physics is, you know, a science. And so that's where you get into these debates and matters of opinion. What is a secure population? So, okay, we saved them, but have we saved enough of them? And how do you want the world to look?
He means, what interests should come first? Those purely of people and the economy? Or restoring fully functional, intact ecosystems? And if the latter is the goal, as it is for a lot of environmental groups?
Delisting is really hard because you're not just hitting your minimum viable population, you're hitting ecological functionality. Well, what's that? That's super hard to determine. And so these are all tough questions to answer.
Coming up, people keep trying to respond to these questions with no easy answers. And it sets up the battles about wolves we have in the Northern Rockies to this day. We'll be back. Welcome back to The Wide Open. Nobody really articulated it during those fights over wolves, but the questions over recovery had a lot more to do with what wolves stood for than with the animals themselves. For centuries, they'd taken on deep symbolic meaning. They made it into our myths and fairy tales.
Open the door and let me in!
Not for the hair on my chinny chin chin!
What a big nose you have! And what big teeth you have! A wolf!
And when introduction came along, there was an old question that still lingered.
The folklore about the wolf has come down through the ages because the wolf is a killer.
Wolves represented the long simmering battle between the urge to preserve the landscape and the need for human progress, rearing its head.
They are about wildness, and the wolf is the ultimate symbol, the ultimate representation of what is wild.
But then there are these new questions, too. Wolves became a symbol of the rural-urban divide, of our country's growing partisan schisms. And the West's economy was quickly changing. Ranching, timber, mining, and other extractive industries that had built the region were on the decline, while tourism was surging.
He's a predator. He's a vicious one. And they don't kill and eat. They just kill for the fun of it.
For both sides, taking a stand on wolves became a proxy for taking a stand on what the West represents. What's striking to me is that so little of it had to do with wolves themselves. Here's Ed Bangs.
There's a ton of issues in the United States that are much, much more important than something like wolf recovery, that we don't do what's on our best interest because we get sidetracked on all these really symbolic issues.
Meanwhile, back in D.C. and around the country, the Endangered Species Act had only become more politically charged.
It became really sobering and discouraging in the early 2000s to see the Endangered Species Act, along with other laws, Clean Water Act, National Environmental Policy Act, become very politicized.
This is Jamie Rappaport-Clark. For years, she was president of the national nonprofit Defenders of Wildlife. But before that, she was also director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under Bill Clinton.
And it became very Democratic as opposed to very Republican. And it has just, over the last decade plus, has just become more and more partisan.
When it came to the wolf fight, Republicans generally wanted to see wolves delisted, while Democrats in general wanted to see them stay on the list. In 2010, wolves had been ping-ponging back and forth, off and on the endangered species list for a few years. Wolves were stuck in limbo, and it seemed like forcing any kind of change would take something new, something radical that went beyond the cycle of litigation that had taken hold. And in 2010, two Montana senators, both Democrats actually, tried to get them off the endangered species list for good with a bill. Max Baucus comes from a ranching family. His time in D.C. started in the House of Representatives back in 1974, the year after the Endangered Species Act passed, actually, with, I should remind you, overwhelming support from both Republicans and Democrats.
Anytime you see a statute of significance passed unanimously, you can be pretty sure that not a lot of thought was put into it.
Baucus was a Democrat, but he was a Democrat from Montana, and he broke with his party on the wolf debate. He'd long thought the ESA was too inflexible, especially for private property owners. He wanted to see wolves delisted. So he, alongside his fellow Democratic senator from Montana, John Tester, wrote up a piece of legislation to remove ESA protection for wolves, specifically in Montana and Idaho, and make that move immune to lawsuits. Tell me about why.
Well, because we have enough wolves. It's pretty simple. The point of the act is to protect species. Well, when a species doesn't have to be protected, they should not be protected. It should be delisted.
The thing was, the bill sidestepped the usual channels. Delisting decisions are supposed to go through the Fish and Wildlife Service at the Department of the Interior. Baucus and Tester's bill did something unprecedented. This decision about what recovery means, one purportedly based on the best available science, was turned over to Congress. They knew it would be a controversial move.
Holy mackerel. You know, the environmentalists nationwide are going to go nuts and just create all kinds of havoc and clamor and yell and scream and all that kind of thing. And sure enough, that's what happened.
Jamie Rappaport-Clark, the former head of the Fish and Wildlife Service turned director of Defenders of Wildlife, was one of the detractors of the bill.
We did everything we knew how to do to stop it because we were so worried, Nick, about the slippery slope.
The slippery slope she's talking about is the idea that if the power to delist a species goes to Congress instead of the Department of the Interior, it politicizes species recovery. It could set a precedent that politicians can ignore science and pander to the loudest or wealthiest voices. That bill failed. But then something fascinating happened. John Tester was up for re-election. His opponent was rabidly anti-wolf, and the polls were showing a razor's edge margin between the two. And in April 2011, a massive budget bill came up for a vote in Congress. At the last second, Tester, along with a Republican from Idaho, dropped language into this massive budget bill that would remove federal protections for wolves in Montana, Idaho, and parts of Washington and Oregon, with no possibility for the question returning to the courts. It was a must-pass bill, and it got the votes it needed. Just like that, wolves became the first species to be delisted through Congress. Jamie Rappaport-Clark was flabbergasted by the move.
Heretofore, the attacks on the Endangered Species Act that had become so partisan were coming from Republicans, and here we had a Democrat that was going to take the first shot over the bow of politicizing through Congress a decision that, since the law had been passed, was reserved to the Secretary of the Interior or Commerce.
We're America. We're a democracy. Winston Churchill said that democracy is the world's worst form of government, except there's none better. Democracy is messy.
This wolf fix isn't about one party's agenda. It's about what's right for Montana and the West, Tester said in a statement at the time. As I write this, John Tester's in the exact same position now as he was then, trying to drum up all the rural support he can to keep his Senate seat in one of the most high-profile races in the country. His campaign told me they were too busy for an interview about wolves, but they did give me a written statement saying Tester was proud of his plan back then and that delisting was a responsible and science-based solution. In the years since, Congress has tried to do this lots and lots more times, with prairie chickens, with northern long-eared bats, even with grizzly bears. But none of those bills have ever been signed into law. In part, due to the legacy of the wolf, delisting remains maybe the largest flashpoint in the ESA world. Ed Bangs, for one, is satisfied enough with how it all went down.
Wolves got delisted, I think, a month before I retired. That was a perfect ending for me, and I was pretty much done at that point, just fighting the whole regulatory lawyering thing.
Ed did get those cocktails on the beach just later than he expected. Today, the situation with wolves is just as complicated as ever. In the years since delisting, there have been state hunts. Here in Montana alone, hunters and trappers have harvested wolf numbers from the mid-200s to low 300s annually for the last few years. That's a lot of dead wolves, but also not enough to make a big dent in the population. And all over wolf country, politicians are still trying to reduce the population. A few years ago, Montana's governor killed a collared Yellowstone wolf in a trap outside the park without the proper hunting certifications. A number of new ways of killing wolves have become legal, things we outlawed back in the days they were headed towards extinction, like neck snares and night hunting, even something approaching bounties on wolves' heads in some places. But despite all that, the overall wolf harvest hasn't noticeably climbed. The elk population here in Montana as a whole is actually higher than it was before wolves were reintroduced. But certain predator-dense areas have undoubtedly seen declines, and some hunters are up in arms about it. In a big way, wolves are booming. As of late 2022, the wolf population in the Northern Rockies as a whole was estimated near 3,000. Since delisting, the wolf population has grown. The area they live in is expanding. Packs are establishing in places they haven't been in a century. I'm going to take a quick detour here because the ESA world is really, really small. I was talking with this one guy, Mike Belchick, senior water policy analyst with the Yurok Tribe in California, for a story you'll hear a couple episodes down the line about something totally different. And it turned out he had had a job in Salmon, Idaho back in 1995. and he actually wound up helping keep some of those wolves alive as they were reintroduced near there.
They were throwing chunks of ice in there, and so I volunteered and we gave them ice.
Today, packs genetically descended from those very same wolves in Idaho have established in Mike's neck of the woods in Northern California. He works with landowners who are learning to coexist much the same way ranchers here in Montana are learning. He told me about one of them.
Like Blair rides around at night with a loudspeaker and a disco light and plays, he says that they really don't like Kanye West. He plays Kanye West on a megaphone or on a speaker and rides around to keep the wolves away.
It's like, Blair, you're suffering through Kanye. Why don't you play something you like? It'd probably be just as effective. And he goes, well, I don't like it, so I figured they wouldn't like it either.
This represents one of the other biggest things happening in the wolf world. Ranchers are learning to coexist with them. I gotta be clear. Playing loud, obnoxious music is just scratching the surface of this world of coexistence. It's taken a lot of learning and experimenting and adapting, but it is happening. And 30 years after reintroduction, surveys in Montana show drastic increases in tolerance for wolves, even among elk hunters and property owners. Still, emotions do run hot on both sides. There have been attempts to delist all wolves in the country, rather than just in part of the Northern Rockies, and to return protections to all wolves, too. And at the local level, people still feel all of it. A guy down the street from me still has a bumper sticker that was popular back in the early wolf days. It says, "Smoke a pack a day," with a silhouette of a wolf with a target over it. Here's Ed.
For me, we got a wolf population recovered. We got them delisted. There's a harvest program in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. The overall wolf population is still doing okay, despite all the rhetoric and all that.
I met with Doug Smith right after a Wyoming hunter made headlines all over the world by running down a wolf on a snowmobile, torturing it, tying it up, and bringing it into a local bar before finally putting it out of its misery. Lots of folks took it as a sign that anti-wolf sentiment had entered the realm of hysteria. Others took all that coverage as an unfair characterization of wolf hunters. As Doug and I drove around the park, grizzlies were on the precipice of delisting too.
People don't trust each other in the United States anymore. So, I mean, a big thing with wolf delisting is a lot of people think wolves have been poorly managed in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. So why should we trust you to delist bears now? So grizzly bears are the next big fight. Should they be delisted? Well, a ton of people are like, not if you're going to manage them like you have wolves, you know, and so it gets into trust, and that's the erosion of everything, you know, and so, yeah, delisting is a really tough area for American culture right now.
As Doug and I drove around the park, we were on a bit of a tight timeline. He had to give a talk that evening, and I'd promised I'd get him back there in time, but we were running a hair late, and we were lost in our chat.
I think most people do have a desire to live in a world that's just not all human, you know, is allowing other creatures to a place to live. And that's an ethical, moral argument. And I think a lot of people feel that way.
The 3,000 odd wolves in the Northern Rockies look a lot different to different folks. It's the largest number of wolves that have roamed this region in a century. But it's also a fraction of what the population once was. It's far too many wolves, or it's far too few. And Doug and I got to talking about the stakes of it all.
I think wolves are indicators of a healthy ecosystem. And I think if we lose them for good forever, I think we endanger our future. I think eventually that'll come back and bite us. I can't put a number on it. I can't prove it to you now. But it feels intuitively correct that, well, where does it stop? Okay, what's the next thing we're going to take away? And what's the impact of that? And then pretty soon it's the next one and the next one. And then it's a human-contrived, controlled landscape. It's all humanity. All of life is up to us. And at some point, we're going to fail it. I think it's the first step of a big unraveling.
This episode is about what it means for something to recover. What happens when it returns to the landscape in numbers? And that also requires grappling with what happens when something doesn't recover, as in, when it goes extinct.
There's something primordial about a wolf howl. And I've heard a wolf howl hundreds and hundreds of times. And it grips you and grabs you in just a way that's ancient. I think losing that makes life a little bit less.
Wolves are charismatic and easy to care about. But one of the questions I've been giving lots of thought as I made this series is this. Whether it's a wolf or a stonefly or a species of buckwheat or a pupfish that lives in a single pool in the middle of the desert, what's it matter if something blips out of existence? Why should we collectively care? There are all kinds of philosophical arguments about the possible utilitarian values of species. We could find a cure for cancer in the leaf of an endangered flower, or about, like with a wolf, a creature's function in the broader ecosystem. In making the show, I've had a lot of conversations about this topic. They're often kind of serious. It's a bit of a bummer to tell stories about species dying out. But in one of those conversations, somebody suggested a reason to avoid extinction that really resonated with me. That accepting even the smallest and most trivial being's demise makes the world a little more lonely. It also makes it a little more boring. And it makes it uglier, too. It's as if there's some kind of magic we lose if we willingly let a species fade away. And I told Doug as much.
He said, you know, if we lose a species, it just makes the world more lonely, boring, and ugly.
It's called intrinsic value. Creatures, individuals, species have value for no other reason than every life has a right to live, has a reason to live. That doesn't mean we don't hunt and we don't kill because everything in the world has to eat something. It just means you respect it. And you don't kill needlessly or wipe things out needlessly. It's all interconnected. Each thing has a right. And I think we're losing that in our culture today. I really do.
Doug and I are parked in the lot of the little event space outside Gardner, Montana, where he's set to give his talk. His audience is already streaming in. We shake hands, and Doug walks in.
Doug, I really appreciate that.
You bet.
I got to let you go because it's...
It is. The crowd's starting to assemble. Is my Nate, always great. You do your research.
Well, thank you.
Let me know.
I make the long drive home as the evening draws nearer, scanning the distant hillsides for silhouettes. Next time on The Wide Open.
I don't think that hunters as a community are very good about facing the rest of the public and giving a story as to why we still belong here.
If there was a hunt, would you put in for it?
It's classified information.
Association of anti-grizz, anti-wolf, anti-conservation, for Jeebus' sake, right? With hunting? The two things don't fit in the same room. You can't jam them in the same clown car.
This episode was reported and written by me, Nick Mott. It was produced by Mary Auld with editorial support from Jewel Banville, Lee Banville, and Corin Cates Carney. Our story editor is Lacey Roberts. Jesse Stevenson created art for the season. Our theme music is by Isaac Opatz, arranged and produced by Dylan Rodrigue, featuring Jordan Bush on pedal steel. Other original music is by Dylan Rodrigue. Jake Birch mixed this episode with help from Alice Sauter. Web design and marketing is by Josh Burnham, and fact-checking is by Victoria Traxler. Special thanks goes to Leah Swartz for the conservation education and support. Thank you so much to everybody I've ever talked with about wolves, which is a whole lot of people. And in particular, thanks to Doug Smith, Ed Bangs, Max Bacchus, and Jamie Rappaport-Clark. And also to David Quammen, who had the lonely, boring, and ugly idea. Please follow us wherever you get your podcasts, leave a review, post on social media, do all the things you can to help us spread the word. I'm Nick Mott. We'll be back in a week with another episode of The Wide Open.
This project was produced in collaboration with the Montana Media Lab at the University of Montana School of Journalism. The Lab is a center for audio storytelling and journalism education that elevates perspectives from underserved communities in the West. Learn more at MontanaMediaLab.com. The Wide Open is also a production of Montana Public Radio. MTPR enriches the mind and spirit, inspires a lifetime of learning, and connects communities through access to exceptional programming. More information at mtpr.org. The Wide Open is supported by the Murray and Jan Ritland Fund, the Cinnabar Foundation, and Humanities Montana.